Yeah, I'm going to pretend that you didn't just blow through my whole interview in 1 minute.
I can talk about storytelling for hours. So
yes, it was just all the little nuggets that I pulled out. I was like, yes, 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 yes. Hello, everyone, and welcome to The Auction Advocate, the podcast where we're all in. I am Erin Shipps, Director of Marketing and Communications for the National Auctioneers Association, and today I've got a very special guest whom we first met at last year's conference and show in Minneapolis. Lori Jacobwith captured our attention with her session on storytelling for fundraising, so much so that I knew I had to bring her back for more. So here we are, continuing that talk on the power of stories, and trust me, if you step into the fundraising arena at all, you need to hear this conversation. Lori, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Erin. I'm delighted and I've been excited for many weeks to get to today.
Named one of America's top 25 fundraising experts, Lori is a nationally renowned master storyteller and fundraising culture change expert. With more than 30 years experience, she has helped nonprofit organizations raise nearly $300 million from individual donors and counting. Lori, every year at conference, there are a few presenters that catch my eye, and being the journalism graduate that I am, you were, of course, one of them. I, in fact, won a state feature writing contest when I was 17. Aww. It's probably my biggest accomplishment as a teenager.
Congratulations.
Thanks. But, you know, because of that, I've always had a love of telling people stories. Mm-hmm. So I really related to your session and your content. And that is what you do at Ignited Fundraising. Your blog has been named one of the top fundraising blogs in 2022. You wrote 9 Steps to a Successful Fundraising Campaign and co-wrote the Essential Fundraising Handbook for Small Nonprofits. You wrote and created the only step-by-step video training program that marries the art of fundraising with the power of storytelling called the Complete Storytelling System. You are simply a powerhouse in the fundraising world. I'm so excited you're here. But what is there anything that you have not done?
I've never had children.
Okay.
Bonus grandchildren. And I didn't realize that was actually the preferred path until they were born. And, you know, now they're 3 and 6 and 9. Mm-hmm. And you can give them back.
Yes, I've heard that.
The fundraising arena, there's not many stones I haven't turned. I love, love, love the way that our work affects real people. And so every aspect of it, whether it be writing a letter or helping an organization with their social media, because everything's a story, right?
Right. And everybody, I always said this, literally everyone has a story.
Yeah.
No matter what your life has been, everyone has a story. So what got you into storytelling?
Well, I like to say, being the oldest of 4 kids, that I used to tell stories that weren't always true. But I was a good storyteller. So I learned, of course, that you, as I grew up from 3 and 5 and 7 and all of that, to tell truthful stories, of course. Mm-hmm. But I got to work with, and this is probably isn't as exciting and appealing these days, but I got to work with politicians back in my early work career. Mm-hmm. And really well seasoned and well respected politicians can tell amazing stories about the people they've met.
Okay, yeah.
And I got to work with our governor here in Minnesota. I got to work with Skip Humphrey's son when he ran for U.S. Congress. And then I got to meet a bunch of people who were powerful communicators. Mm-hmm. And I've just been always drawn to the power of what is your, you know, personal founding story or that story that really got you started in life? And how do we listen in a way that can sometimes fill in the blank for people who are timid in telling their story so we can evoke an even more powerful story to share back with our community?
Yeah, I want to get into that a little bit later too. How did you transition from that into working then with nonprofits?
So after a couple of political campaigns, I knew, even though my dream had been to be governor of Minnesota and help everyone in Minnesota, I didn't want that job. But I had some good fundraising skills. You know, this was back in the late 80s, so a really long time ago when I had black hair, not gray. I got to take my now well-honed fundraising skills, and I knew I wanted to work in the nonprofit sector, the social sector. And so my first job was a grant writing job, wrote 160 grant proposals that year.
Wow.
But I also sent out one written appeal, and I included a story. We raised more in that individual appeal than more than half of the grant proposals. And the organization was astounded. They hadn't really dipped their toe into individual giving. And so now I knew I was sort of onto something. I took a little detour and worked at a company that was a marketing and a sales promotion company, where, of course, the spin, the story that you tell is how you help your clients generate more sales. And my client that I worked with was the Subway Kids meal called Kids Pack. So I got to tell all the kind of grumpy franchise owners back in the day who were mostly men then, how to market to kids. And I would tell them about how they would sell more when they put the kids meal on their menu because kids would bring their parents.
Yes.
So it was a story, you know, spinning the story to do whatever needed to happen and then just watching it unfold and then coming back to the nonprofit sector. I have not left since then.
Oh, that's a great story. So I want to talk about storytelling. Obviously, that's why we're here. At the basic level of storytelling, why does it work?
Our brains are wired to think in story. We cannot make a decision without feeling something. And the way we feel something is through the stories we tell ourselves. And in the social sector, we get the opportunity to affect how you tell yourself a story, what you're speaking about. Fundraising in and of itself is about fulfilling the aspirations of our supporters, making a better world, cleaning the water, whatever it is. And so making sure that we're touching people's heads and hearts. Stories are 22 times more memorable than facts. But when you blend the facts, especially the money facts about what it takes to do something, and then the story is really compelling, now you've got the entree to causing someone to take action. The most important way to change human behavior is through that emotional connection that we can make with someone.
Yeah, I'm going to pretend that you didn't just blow through my whole interview in 1 minute.
I can talk about storytelling for hours. So
yes, it was just all the little nuggets that I pulled out. I was like, yes. Okay, so you say that storytelling inspires people at a bigger level. What does that mean to you?
So empathy. Think about what's going on right now. You know, timely. We've got a war in the Ukraine. There's been an outpouring from churches, individuals, communities. A radio station that I love here in the Twin Cities raised $100,000 in 4 days to send to an organization helping the Ukraine. We can do good, and we do, by ourselves. And we can do so much more collectively. So when a social profit organization, nonprofit organization, utilizes powerful messaging, putting a face on your mission and action, what we can accomplish in making sure your mission is doing exactly what you want it to be doing is so much more. So I like to remind people, yes, you might serve 35,000 people or 350 people, but that's a statistic. That's a number to me. That's not an engaging something until you say, let me put a face on that for you. So Tony is 84 years old, and he lights up when his daughter walks in the room, even though he cannot remember who she is. He knows he knows her. And without the care he receives at that special care center and the extra dollars that are raised in the benevolence fund to give him slippers and things that his insurance doesn't cover, he wouldn't find joy in his day at the level that you want your loved ones to be finding joy.
Mm,
Okay. So there's just more that we can have people take action on when the story is compelling, right?
Listen, I just got choked up at that 30-second story. You are fabulous.
Well, Tony isn't what my dad's name is, but I was kind of talking about my dad.
And yeah, that's why it hits right in the heart, right? Because it's real.
There was a moment, literally, Erin, two summers ago. My dad passed away just before the pandemic. So three summers ago now. But there was it was almost like a parachute, it looked like, but it was a rainbow umbrella that covered the whole courtyard. And all the people in their wheelchairs are all, you know, sort of around the edges, and they're getting their snack and they're getting whatever. And I went to see my dad almost every day. And I walked out and across the courtyard. He saw me in the doorway and his eyes lit up. Aww. And he smiled, and he didn't know who I am or was, but he hadn't recognized me for a while. And I literally just, my chest expanded. I got tears in my eyes, and I just thought, I know these people are underpaid, but I don't care. You know, they are doing something that is causing my dad to feel comfortable and happy.
Yeah.
And he knows who I am today. It's a really good day.
Yeah. Oh, you are getting me right in the heart. My dad passed away in October 2020. So yeah, not much longer after yours. And he was in hospice care for a while. And that same feeling about being just in awe of the people who did the things that he couldn't do for himself at the end. It was, yeah.
Yeah.
Whew, okay, I'm going to reconnect.
Special. Yes.
I'm going to regroup here. Stop making me cry. we'll get past this. You talk about the science that goes along with storytelling. Let's talk about that a little bit.
Well, think about what we were told about the brain. There's a logical, rational side, right? And then there's that emotional side. And when I was a kid, I was taught that there's like two separate parts of the brain.
Yep.
But in more recent years, probably last 10 years or so, what we know is there's a continual tension between those two sides of the brain, and they're always working together. Mm-hmm. So I've had development professionals or communication professionals probably more than 10 years ago now used to say, oh, but we have a lot of accountants and bankers and lawyers. They're not going to respond to the story. Well, the actual truth is they have to have the story because the numbers alone won't cause them to write the bigger check.
Right.
So at a fundraising event, when you insert a live testimonial that's just about how the person feels, what they felt like when they walked through your doors, what they felt like during the time you walked alongside them, and where they are now. I've watched organizations increase revenue 30%, 60%, 182%. And that's all the different kinds of, you know, jobs and people in the room. But there was a person to attach the need that you're discussing to. And I had empathy for their courage, for their tenacity, especially if it's somebody who's come back over and over. So there's a neurological something going on. I'm not a scientist, but I know enough science to know without both, we cannot cause people to take action.
Yeah. So my dad was a psychologist. So I've always been in my own head, so to speak. I love what you say about how everything we do is based on a story we tell ourselves. When you said that, my mind went exploded. Okay. I don't know. That doesn't happen too often for me in life, but it was so good. And I want to talk about it more because we don't think about the stories we tell ourselves. Mm-mm. They just happen. So what are some of those stories that we tell ourselves just
every
day?
Where do we work? What job do we take? What shoes do we put on today? I went to the post office. It's raining here. And I truly decided I'm just going to wear my hood and not bring an umbrella because I want to see the sky. I want to feel the rain on my face. And, you know, I told myself a story about why I was doing that. I think, you know, I've been told the first 17 seconds when you wake up, what you say in your brain to yourself causes you to have a good, bad, or somewhere in the middle day. And that's more recent research on the neurology of what's going on in our brain. Those circuits have a lot to do with our experience of our day.
So you're telling me when I wake up and I say, ugh, like I'm going to have a bad day.
Well, you might bump into things a little more regularly or, you know, so I've changed what I say to myself.
Yeah.
And one of the things that the story that I tell myself, and sometimes I have to say it a lot, Erin, is everything always works out for me. It sometimes doesn't feel like it, but if when I'm saying that, it just calms me down. And I can think through, oh, yeah, you know, that day really was a not great day. And yet, I got through it. I handled it. Example, a client I'm working with right now, we had our leadership meeting yesterday morning. There was someone already speaking to us before I even got into my seat, and it was to let us know that one of the alumni students at this high school had committed suicide the night before.
Oh, wow.
And two of his siblings still go to the school. So now it was, okay, what's the crisis plan that we have to make sure those two children, those students are cared for, the family is respected, our students know what's going on without the gossip.
Right.
It was all kinds of storytelling going on. And the reminder that we are here to hold a container of safety. That's the story we've told these students and their parents. So all decisions are made with that intention in mind. It changed. We didn't hold our meeting, you know, the way we were going to. It pivoted the whole day and the rest of the week. And yet we could have gone into drama and trauma. And this is horrible. And what will we do? But because there was some training that had happened, everybody was in a, yes, this is, and there was grieving and there was tears, don't get me wrong.
Right.
But it was in a, how do we make sure our students are cared for in this moment? And that's a story. Even if it's just a little tiny slice like that, what I call that is a mission moment. What is the mission moment around what we're thinking, what we're feeling about our organization in action? So I asked everybody to put themselves in the shoes of the family for a moment and think, we're not going to ask them what they need because they're in shock. We are going to say, here's the plan we have. How do you feel about that? Very different way to have that conversation.
Yeah, that's really, really good. Something else you said, which I find very powerful, is that knowledge doesn't cause people to take action.
No.
That facts are not stories. Talk about that a little bit.
So let's give an example. You can know that there are hundreds of millions of people on the planet who don't have clean drinking water. So what if it doesn't affect you in some way? So Charity Water, the folks at Charity Water, do an amazing job of putting a face, one face at a time, on what that means. Now, here's the interesting hook. I started giving to them back in 2009 or 10, maybe, when I heard a story of a young girl named Rachel, who was about herself, 9 or 10 years old, who had held a fundraiser for Charity Water. Her church talked about it, and she was going to raise $300 instead of getting presents for her birthday. She raised like $240 and unfortunately was hit in a car accident a week or so later and died.
Oh my goodness.
So the community started to band together. Then Charity Water heard about it. They shared that message with their community. The news picked it up. And Erin, $1.2 million was raised in honor of Rachel's decision to give her birthday to Charity Water. So now every year, on the anniversary of that event, I get an update telling me about the wells that were built because we gave to that campaign.
Wow.
So the story can be over many years.
Right.
And a difficult, tragic situation can be turned into something beautiful. I got to see pictures of her mother and her grandmother on site watching the water flow from the well in a village in Africa. How cool is that?
That's so cool.
So storytelling, I believe, just so you know, we misuse it. Mm-hmm. We put a bunch of facts together. She was a girl who was 17 years old and she didn't want to go to school and she da 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 da. But we don't talk about feelings. We don't talk about what the situation is that was transformational and how that caused some life-changing feelings. I like to say the exact results, the roof over your head or the graduation or the job, all of that is important, but it has to be woven together with that transformational part that we can't measure, that we can describe in, well, if it was on our phone, we'd use emojis, but it's not. So we're going to use words, right? So that man that was I was talking about at the beginning, who was, you know, really my dad, I would describe his hands as gnarled and leathery instead of he was an old man sitting in a wheelchair.
Yeah.
So you get a different visual. We're painting a picture with our words. And in this life that we live of fast pace and scroll, scroll, scroll on our phone, we don't pause long enough to put words that are thoughtful words and descriptive words into our stories. We list a bunch of facts and say, here's a story, now give us a lot of money.
Yeah.
So I call that lazy storytelling.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, that's good. I'm just picturing myself, you know, doing the scrolling that we all do and thinking of all those stories I'm being told. And then I then continue to tell myself because I saw them. And yeah, it's just such a throwaway story.
Well, if you're in the story, you know you can make a difference. If it's help us reach our goal, you're not in the story.
Yeah.
It feels like duty and obligation.
Yeah.
And everybody needs something from Aaron. My guess is in your position every day, somebody's got their hand out. Can you do this and this and this and that? But if you're invited to participate in something, even, you know, as you're looking through pictures on Instagram or whatever it is, there's something that hooks you. And that usually is you're in the language, you're in the messaging in some way.
Mm. Yeah, that makes sense. What is the difference? Because you're talking about the difference between knowing something and feeling something. What is the difference there?
Oh, gosh. The feeling part of what we do is the part we cannot measure. The knowing part comes with some statistics or graphs, and we can often measure it. So the homeowner for a Habitat for Humanity affiliate who gets the keys handed to them and the child who's running through their first bedroom after they've been couch hopping for many years, saying this family just got a new home is the knowing part. Saying safety looks like a smile from ear to ear on little Ian's face. And you made that possible by supporting Habitat for Humanity.
Mm-hmm.
So now you feel something about that little boy. And if there's even a little more to say, he's never had a bedroom before. He slept on the couch or the floor of loved ones for years. Or maybe they've rented an apartment, but the whole family slept in the same bedroom. But giving a little context to why safety and joy is that little boy's face. Can you imagine being a parent and being able to give your child their first bedroom after the however many hundreds of hours of sweat equity you put in to build your home, and to know that their life is going to be better and different than yours was? I can't imagine that feeling of pure joy and love that just, you know, their trajectory of their life just changed because you got those keys.
Yeah. And I like what you said. This, I think it's along the same lines, but correct me if I'm wrong. When you have a nonprofit who says, well, the people at our events, they're not going to relate to little Timmy who got a new house because they've never been homeless. They've never been through hard times. And I think what you talk about in that situation is the empathy versus the sympathy.
Yeah.
Is that right?
For sure. So sympathy, the more research I've done on it, is there's some judgment in sympathy. So it's a distancing emotion. Empathy is, where did you put your head last night? Hopefully on a pillow, on a bed, in your warm house. Well, Ian gets the opportunity to do that in the first time in his 7 years of being on the planet. He gets the first time to do that tonight because he and his mom just picked up the keys to their new home that they helped build together. You made that possible for them. So the difference is you're, again, in that story. And I remind you, or the teller reminds you, what it is you have that they might not in a way that causes you to feel sorry for them, but to remind you that that's a right that we all deserve. You know, the other thing that happens, and you probably get this at many of the events that your auctioneers work at, stories for some organizations are, it takes a little more digging to find them.
Yeah.
So if you are helping Eagles, we've got the National Eagle Center in southern Minnesota here, or you're keeping water clean, or you're helping pets get adopted, or you're doing advocacy work, I like to explain that there's always an end user. So the Eagles do something to make the ecology healthier, but then that allows my children or grandchildren, if I have them, nieces or nephews, to experience our community in a different way. So bringing it to the end user of what happens when someone helps advocate for that bill to be passed. Well, rent equity happens because that organization, you know, got support through that legislation or whatever it is. But now go find one person that you can talk about or make them up. It is okay to say, we have not met anyone yet who's benefited from this legislation or this project. But let me tell you about the person I think that would.
Yeah.
It's a person named Rachel, and here's what her family is dealing with, and here's what she's had to deal with the rent going up and down and being evicted through the pandemic and You can tell me a story about a person based on what you know the people's lives are who are experiencing that very issue.
Yeah, this goes directly into my next question, of course, because many times our fundraising auctioneers, they come across nonprofit clients who genuinely don't know how to talk about themselves. And I know that you talk about this a lot. Is there any other advice you would give to them for helping pull that messaging out of their nonprofits?
There's a couple of things. So the very best place to collect a story from, and I like to say our job is to collect the nuggets of the story, and then we weave it together in a language that is respectful and honoring and empathy inducing.
Yeah.
But to ask someone that we walk alongside, whether it be that person at the legislature who really believes in this bill, why are you doing this? Or the advocate for pet adoptions, or the senior at the care center, you know, like my dad, to talk to them and just ask them open-ended questions. How did you feel? What happened? What did you like? What did you not like? And have them tell you their story. Often it takes an hour of listening to find the 6 or 8 nuggets that you'll weave together to tell the story. When the right open-ended questions are asked, you can retell their story to them. And oftentimes they get emotional because you've captured their tenacity, their courage, their willingness to just keep putting one foot in front of the other in a way that they would never say. The other person or people to gather nuggets from are, of course, our frontline staff, person answering the phone, person working in our programming. And I like to say, tell me about someone you can't get off your mind.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just tell me about them. You don't have to tell me a story. I'll just ask you questions. Well, why'd you like them? Why do they stand out? How long have you known them? What age are they? And then the nuggets start to come that, again, we put together into that package of, here are the measurable results. Here are the transformations that are not measurable. And we include words that remind me I'm connected to that person in some way, or there, but for the grace of God, go I.
Mm-hmm.
So we can see ourselves in that story, or a loved one of ours in that story. I think that's the difference in my mind between a good story and a master story, is people don't feel any different about that person other than huge respect.
Yeah.
If it's a story that is a bunch of facts kind of thrown together and I'm supposed to feel something, but it really doesn't cause me to feel something, I usually feel sorry for them, or why don't they just get a job?
Mm-hmm.
And that's not the kind of storytelling I'm about.
No. No, not at all. And that is a lot of the storytelling that is out there.
Yeah.
Every day. A lot of times, I mean, our fundraising auctioneers find themselves in the position of consulting a lot with their nonprofit clients, even to the point of helping them put together the visual elements that are going to be accompanying these stories at a live event or hybrid event or whatever it is, virtual event. They're doing all kinds of events now. What types of visual elements do you think are the most important when telling a story to a crowd?
It runs the gamut. Mm-hmm. So I've done a couple of webinars on different aspects of this a number of times. This is going to sound weird, Erin, but body parts.
Okay.
You know, think of a, like I took pictures of my dad holding my hand many times.
Yep.
I did. Because too. I wanted to remember A, his touch, but I also wanted to see the love and the aged hand with all those age spots and the beauty of who he is, even though he cannot remember me. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't have to be a face. It can be a story of, we'll call him Henry, and the holding of the hands, right? Or there's a lot of careful storytelling around children. We don't want to tell their last name, or we don't want to show their face.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to Mexico City to do storytelling training for nonprofits down there a couple of different times. And I got to go to the top of some pyramids that are nearby.
Yeah.
And there was a little place at the top of this pyramid, and there were 20 children all putting their finger on that spot at the same time.
Cool.
And I took a picture of that. You couldn't see their faces, but a picture like that of children doing something. They're coloring, or they're, and then you tell the story of one, and, you know, look at the one with the bracelet that's bright pink, and let me tell you about her. Mm-hmm. So pulling one out of the mix, or, you know, it could be the sound. A story doesn't have to have always a visual. It could be the sound. I took a quick it was video, but because I don't have an audio recorder on my phone, of my grandson sleeping the other night. Because I wanted him to hear himself snoring the next day. He was mesmerized. He's six. That he could snore that loud. But so imagine the raspy breathing of someone at a hospital, and we're raising money for the blah, 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 you know, equipment that will help that person live a healthier life.
Mm-hmm.
So we can give a first name to the story. It doesn't always have to. I wouldn't give a picture of the equipment. That's not really inspiring.
No.
But it could be an audio of the noise of that raspy and say, this will go away when we raise the $1.2 million to buy that equipment for our patients.
Wow. I'm thinking about being in a ballroom with all these people and just turning off all the lights and just playing that sound.
Yes.
How powerful. It's so powerful. And it seems like what you're saying is focusing on the very minute details, the hands, the children's hands touching this one little spot. focusing in on those little details is such a more powerful visual or auditory that they're yeah. yes.
Yeah. It's piece. A story.
Yeah.
It's a story for our ears. So I'll give you an example. I worked with a domestic abuse counseling center for a number of years back many years ago. And one thing we did at one of their events, we darkened the room, just as you said, and we played snippets of 10 different calls that came in.
Wow.
The arc of them. So first we got all the, hi, we didn't hear their name. I'm standing at the bus stop. It's pouring rain. And then we got the arc of the, here's what I need. And there was not a dry eye. And there, you could have heard a pin drop when we stopped because it was so raw and real, but we didn't abuse anyone's confidentiality. That is what the staff has to deal with every single day.
Yeah.
And the room got it that A, we need more staff. B, we need more dollars to train and support the staff. But also, if you're someone walking through our doors, we want to be the very best that we can be for you because you're in such a difficult situation.
Yeah, I love that example of those calls because it's one, you know, could be 30-second moment in time.
Yeah.
And many times people try to pack in an entire life story in one little promo or speech. And it's like those little moments are so much more powerful.
Well, that's the thing. The nuggets, the mission moments that are not 14 minutes long.
Yeah.
The look that someone gave someone on the way out the door on the last time they were with you, describing that in detail for 30 seconds is a very different way of telling a story. Or it could be the look in a stock photo. I've got an organization that used a side view of a child's face. We couldn't tell who the child was, but it talked about you equals hope for the children who walk through our doors. So it was a profile, but it was and it was in black and white, but it still was a real person. So having little nuggets lead up to the event, and then in the event, making sure you're surrounded by the mission and mission moments. So quotes on the tables. There's a clothesline of t-shirts that was for this domestic violence center. The stories on those t-shirts, we walked through them and had to read them as we walked into the ballroom. There's no opportunity to not feel what some of those families were feeling. So I say utilize the space on the bathroom mirror with images, quotes, and pictures in the elevator. Really tell a story in the elevator. Like there's four sentences and a picture or a, you know, two hands. Or so every space is open for opportunity to have your mission felt when you're having an event. You're immersing people in the transformation of your work.
Yeah, that's what that's the word I was thinking of was immersive. And just picturing myself, because you're such a good storyteller, picturing myself that in that environment, and how I tend to maybe get easily distracted when the story is bad or I'm bored.
We do. Right.
But if that message is literally everywhere you look and it's different and it's varied and the delivery is varied, the message is varied, it's impossible not to be immersed.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's good. Okay. Switching up a little bit, why do nonprofit fundraisers need to talk about money more?
Oh, it's my soapbox. Thank you.
You're welcome.
And you're going to have to give me the hook because I'll go too long.
Okay, cut it off.
So here's the thing. The story can be really powerful. I can get a visual. I can feel connected to that senior who's got Alzheimer's or that child learning to read or whatever your mission is. If you don't let me know that there is a gap in your funding from where you are today and where you must be to say yes to everyone who walks through your doors, I don't know what to do. So I give you $100 or I give you $200 because that feels good to me, mm-hmm. right? When you say, so someone else taught me this. When I worked at the Department of, it was actually at Prevent Blindness America down mm-hmm. in Phoenix, Arizona. The mom of one of our kids who'd had her eyes screened, 5-year-old little girl, Madison, her mom found out because of our screeners, her daughter was blind in her left eye. She had amblyopia, which mm-hmm. is lazy eye. Mm-hmm. And with a patch and glasses, she was going to have her eye trained to perfect vision. She now has 20/10 vision in both her eyes, and she's wow. in her 20s, right? But the mom would go with me and talk about it takes one camera and about 6 to 8 volunteers to do a vision screening. We are screening 250 kids a year, and my child, fortunately, was one of them. Mm-hmm. There are thousands of children waiting, and we know when you catch an eye problem before the age of 5 or 6, it can be 100% corrected much of the time. But a camera costs $2,500. And training volunteers, it's about $14 per volunteer. So we know that when we have more of both, we can screen more children. Mm-hmm. When I left 2.5 years later, we went from 12 volunteers to 890.
Wow.
We went from one grant of $80,000 to $1.2 million coming from individuals. But what's more important, because we talked about what it takes financially, we were not screening 250 kids anymore. Mm-hmm. We were screening 25,000 children a year.
It's incredible.
And that I really equate that to Paula, Madison's mom, reminding mm-hmm. me and teaching me, talk about the money. The mm-hmm. more you talk about the money, not in a begging, asky way, the more money you will raise mm-hmm. because now people know what to do.
Yeah. Well, see, you didn't go on too long about that. We're good. Got it to the point. Do you have an example of a storyline that you took from really bad to, okay, this works?
Mm. I do. I could tell you one right this second.
Love it.
Let me see if I have it here to read to you, because the bad one, it was really, really bad. And the ones that aren't so bad, and then I, you know, did my best to clean it up a little bit. Let's see. And it's not your typical children and puppies and that kind of story.
Yeah.
So this was a real story someone gave me. Mm-hmm. Her name is Molly. Dr. Molly Mooden, she's our new general practitioner for a 500-mile radius outside my rural town of Brookview, Ohio. When you fall asleep, just start like snoring, because then you know the audience will be snoring with you, right?
I'm already
Dr. Mooden
out.
Is now practicing medicine in rural Ohio because Physicians for Rural Communities PAC worked at blah, 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 right?
Yes.
So what I did is I took that story and worked with them. As a young girl, Molly Mooden pretended she was a doctor, even when others told her little girls grow up to be nurses, not doctors.
So good.
Molly knew that she wanted to help as many people as possible, and she, often tired at the end of her day, did everything she could to learn about being a doctor and eventually made it into medical school. In the first year of medical school, when it's hard and coming at you like a fire hose, she learned about a bill we were working to get passed that was up for a vote in the state legislature. It was to create a rural tax credit so doctors like her could live in a rural community and get a stipend of $5,000 a year that would go towards their previous bills, whatever they incurred in medical school. So in between the long days of studying, she spent hours spearheading a letter-writing campaign. Now, I'm not certain it was totally Molly's doing, but her work helped cause that bill to be passed. It was probably the tipping point. When it was time to look for a real job, she came to my community, and I am proud to call her my general practitioner. And Molly Mooden will see my children, my grandchildren, and I hope live here and change our community forever. Like, right? Like,
oh,
just a
man.
Different story. So it's about advocacy, but it's about a person mm-hmm. who helped the advocacy happen.
Yeah.
You know, we do all have stories. I don't care what organization we are. We mm-hmm. just have to think about the trajectory of what someone's life was like because they got connected to your organization. That could be a volunteer. Mm-hmm. That could be a donor. That could be your CEO and founder. That could be a client. Mm-hmm. That could be a vendor who continues to give free services because they love how they feel when they drop off the whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
There's a story everywhere.
Yeah. I wish that everybody could see me during those two versions of stories, because one, I was like looking around. And Lori can see me, but you know, nobody else can. And I'm just looking around the room so bored. And then the next one, I'm like, my eyes are wide and I'm nodding like, yes, yes, that's a great story. So the
disadvantage. Could use a little cleaning up. I still have some work to do on it. But you know, it gives you the essence of take time, people. Mm-hmm. Don't rush to put the next newsletter out. Take an extra 15 minutes or 10 minutes to make sure that story, that you speak it out loud. Don't just write it. Speak it mm-hmm. out loud, because you'll say the words differently when you speak it out loud.
Oh, yeah.
And tell it to someone and get their reaction. If mm-hmm. their eyes glaze over, go back and rewrite it.
Yes, 100%. I like to read things out loud a lot to see how it sounds, because how it sounds is what people are going to read in their head.
Yeah.
I want to end with something you say that really got me, a third thing, at least third thing. But you talk about storytelling year round, which I think is such a necessary piece of this nonprofit puzzle. As part of that year round effort, which includes all kinds of messages and marketing, you say, and this is the part that got me, that no one cares about a goal.
Right.
And because we've grown up with telethons and our auctioneers do fund to needs all the time, that focus is so much, if we can just hit this number, you know, if not a goal, what is it that nonprofits and fundraising professionals should focus their messaging on?
Mm-hmm. A person. Mm-hmm. So I like how you started that, Erin. You can take that story about a person and tell it all year long mm-hmm. so that when we get to the gala and the fund a need, we know little Madison mm-hmm. really well, or my dad, or, you know, Henry, whomever it is. And you can say, so we want to say yes to more Henrys. Mm-hmm. We want to say yes to more Madisons. Here's what it'll take to do that, folks. We've got to get to $1 million tonight. Mm-hmm. We're almost there, but we can't say... Always equating it to the person. I like to remind folks, we're supposed to get folks ready to give versus expect them to give. Mm. So 3 to 6 months before the event, start sprinkling little tidbits of mission moments mm-hmm. about the person you'll highlight at your event, mm-hmm. the person who's going to give their testimonial. So I know, so I feel like they're a friend or they're someone I've walked alongside for mm-hmm. weeks and months now. And when I see them stand up on stage and they tell their story, I'm as proud as I can be, because you've talked about the fear or the shame mm-hmm. or the frustration or the anger or the whatever it is. And then that moment comes when they say that line or two that the person like you or I have helped, you know, weave into their telling of their mm-hmm. story, where I feel myself. I feel what they're feeling. And now my giving goes up.
Yeah.
So you want to say what $1,000 will do for Henry. Mm-hmm. What would $10,000 do for someone like Henry? And how many more Madisons can we talk to and work with when we reach 100,000 or 500,000 or whatever. So it's blending that people and money story all year long. So when we get to the event, we're like ready, like get out of my way. I'm ready to hear more about this person, but I'm also ready to give mm-hmm. at a level. I've watched people come to an event with a $50 check or a corporate check of $1,000. And then walk up to the development person or the CEO and say, I want you to tear this up. I was so moved tonight by that person's story. We're going to triple that or quadruple that, or I'm going to do that over 5 years or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. It changes their preconceived notion about what they should be giving.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes. And I think the other piece that you talk about with that is to talk about not about what it costs, but what it takes.
What it takes. Yeah.
I like that.
We don't care about what it costs. You're not buying something.
Mm-hmm.
What it takes to put a smile on someone's face here, what it takes to give someone hope, what it takes to cure cancer. Those are powerful statements, inclusive words. You're in the messaging then, mm-hmm. because I can be a part of what it takes. Back to what we said at the very beginning, fundraising is about fulfilling the aspirations of our supporters. Mm-hmm. Our goal is about balancing a budget. Mm. Nobody cares about the budget. They don't care about the goal. They care about doing more and having a bigger impact.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the what it takes language.
Yeah. Oh, thank you, Lori. That's the end of our Q&A part. It's game time now.
Okay.
Thankfully, I did not pick a competitive game because you told me that you are very competitive and I don't want that energy right now of maybe winning because I am also a little competitive.
We could tie.
Okay. I mean, I could finagle that to happen, but as much as I love interviewing awesome people, there's really nothing I love doing more than taking professionals with decades of experience, awards, and accolades and making them do hilarious stuff with me simply for my own entertainment. So, and our audience seems to enjoy it too. So there we go. I'm introducing a new game today. Created specifically for you.
Okay.
But I will translate it to other guests, I believe.
Good.
But it's a new game called Super Scientific Internet Quizzes.
Mm.
Because we all know that they are. in this game, you'll have to take a quiz with me from the World Wide Web and then reveal your results to our audience. And because you can find literally anything on the internet, I found a quiz called What Type of Storyteller Are You?
Oh.
Right? It's perfect. So, let's get to it. I'm going to find this here, open up this link, and I'm going to read you the questions, and it's multiple choice.
I can't wait.
Oh, so exciting. It's I feel like I'm setting this up to be really awesome, and then we're going to be like, oh, that was kind of lame.
Well, I have bells here to ring.
I love
the answer right, so.
See, I need one of those, like, sound effects boards that I can just, like, punch in it would get really cheesy, I'm sure. Okay, question number one. It says, okay, your audience is ready. Campfire optional. How do you start your story? A, with a great example or metaphor. B, by defining your topic. C, with a shock. Or D, with humor. And you, if you hate all those, you have to pick one.
I would start it with some sort of shock.
Yeah.
Some sort of hook.
Okay, number two, your choice of words is A, relaxed and clear, B, carefully chosen and specific, C, bold and exaggerated, or D, creative and luxurious.
Oh my.
It's a lot.
What was B again?
Carefully chosen and specific.
That would be my choice woven into some of the others, but carefully chosen and specific.
And number three, you mostly want your audience to feel A, clarity, B, confident, C, inspired, or D, happy.
C, inspired.
I think I could have guessed that one in the line of work that you're in.
Yeah.
number four, you hold audience attention with A, relatable examples, B, the depth of your knowledge, C, your infectious positivity, or D, plot twists.
A.
Yeah. Maybe I could have just filled this out for you. I think after our conversation, maybe. Okay. Number five, your favorite prop is A, to not have one, B, a diagram or chart, C, photos and videos, or D, an object that links different parts of your story and gives it scale.
So I'm going to say A, but I would also say pauses, intentional pauses in my story.
Okay. No props. Got it. Number six, your story ends with A, a pleasing resolution, B, a look at what else is out there, C, a call for action, or D, a cliffhanger? Yeah.
To get people to take action, often a happy ending story is what's used.
Mm-hmm.
But what I know from the research on storytelling, the stories that cause people to take the most action don't have an ending yet. So I would say then that's the cliffhanger.
Okay. I like that. Okay. And I'm going to put in my email address so that you're not getting spammed. Because you have to give them your email address to get
But you'll results. Share with me what kind of storyteller I am.
Of course. Now they'll spam my work email. That'll be great. It says you are an educator.
Ooh, I hope so.
Yeah. It says you naturally use stories to share your passions with the world and impart some of the knowledge you've gained. Your storytelling superpower is fostering curiosity and making every topic interesting. Resources to support this type of storyteller include, well, this is, I haven't even read this, but ensure you don't miss key bits of information in your story by planning it out in advance with a storyboard. And if you'll be including data or charts in your story, which no, learn how to turn them into visually pleasing and easily digestible animations.
Yes. There you go.
This is so accurate.
Very cool. Thank you.
Yeah. So the other types were, simplifying storytellers, motivational storytellers, and entertaining storytellers.
Oh, sure.
So
I can be entertaining sometimes.
Yeah. Well, and also, also motivational. So I think you're just a master storyteller. So you are all of these things.
Thank you.
But that's it for our super scientific internet quiz.
I love that.
Yay.
Thanks for doing the research.
Well,
you have a huge research department helping you. I can tell.
Correct. I am also the producer of this show and the host. Yes. So it's all up to me.
So you have multiple superpowers.
maybe so. I think that's what I'll start my morning off by saying now.
That's it. That's the story, Erin.
Yes.
I have multiple superpowers. Which ones do I choose to use today?
See, no more sighing when I wake up. That is it. That's going to get me out of bed.
Let me know how it goes.
We'll try it out. Lori, I adore you. Thank you so much for being here today. Your insights are really mindset changing and so powerful.
Thank you.
Yeah,
I've enjoyed every second of our conversation. You are delightful, smart, fun, and probably overworked. And so that you took the time to do this, I'm just really honored.
Oh, well, thank you, Lori. I'm going to play that recording of your voice every day for myself for motivation. Find tons more tools for fundraising at Lori's website, ignitedfundraising.com. You will not be disappointed with what is on your fabulous website. Without NAA's conference and show, I might not have heard Lori's incredible message, which is why it is so important to attend conference and engage in the education provided. We have some fantastic outside speakers coming in again this year in San Diego, and what they have to say, just like Lori, will stick with you for years to come. Check out our schedule and register now at conferenceandshow.com. Also, don't forget National Auctioneers Week is next week, May 2nd through the 7th, with National Auctioneers Day on Saturday, May 7th. We will have some awesome content to share, so keep an eye on our Facebook page and your email for more information. We are excited to celebrate you. On behalf of the National Auctioneers Association, I'm Erin Shipps, thanking you for tuning in to The Auction Advocate, and we're so glad you're all in with us.